The Book of Equanimity, Case 94, Dongshan, Unwell. Dongshan was unwell. A monk asked, "Your Reverence is unwell. Is there someone, after all, who is not sick?" Dongshan said, "There is." The monk asked, "Does the unsick person take care of Your Reverence?" Dongshan said, "This old monk is properly taking care of that one." The monk asks, "And how about when Your Reverence takes care of that one?" Dongshan said, "Then the old monk does not see that there is illness." Let us appreciate the enormous privilege that we have to be here on retreat. We have sufficient time in our lives to use discretionarily. We have a job that lets us take time away, or a family that doesn't need our urgent care to get by. We can pay the registration fees or find a way to get here to Worcester from wherever we come. Recently, there was a black woman in Texas who died in police custody. She was pulled over and put in jail for not using a turn signal. We have the privilege to be able to arrive at Sesshin unhindered by the police. There are churches in the south burning down. We have the privilege to come to this temple which, though it may receive some grief from the city regarding our tax-exempt status here, it is not an object of hatred and destruction. There is great suffering in the world. The world itself is suffering greatly. We are here on the edge of a cliff. The three of us guiding teachers, along with Dharma holders James and Diane, recently were at a Western Dharma Teachers Conference, as in non-Asian Dharma Teachers Conference, people from all over the world. And for me, it was quite a... I'm going to use the word awakening. There was time spent at that conference looking at issues of privilege and oppression, race and racism. There was some time spent looking at a history of what it has been like for black people in America for the last 350 years. It was heartbreaking, excruciating to really look at. Reminded me of when I was in Hiroshima and went through the war museum there, sobbing. At this conference also, there was some really powerfully presented and really clear and clear-eyed and deeply informed presentations about the state of the environment, climate change. It required, and part of what really looking at these things was, and so that one of the presentations about climate change by a really powerful speaker who meets with governments and business leaders and religious leaders all over the world and scientific leaders. He was so vastly informed about these things and really taking action. And we heard one presentation about the kind of a generalized statement of the difficulties that the environment is facing. Then we heard another one, this guy's presentation, that pointed out that the one we just heard was so Pollyanna-ish. His presentation, not in a fear-raising kind of way, included the phrase, the catastrophic fall of civilization in the foreseeable future. We are here on the cliff's edge. I realized how much I spend time not looking at this, turning away from this. Our practice in Zen, we're very clear, isn't quietism. It is not staying on top of the 100-foot flagpole. We're very clear on this in Boundless Way. We don't just sit in the ghost cave of samadhi and let everything fall away. Our practice includes getting up, walking, serving, chanting, coming to Dokusan, receiving instructions, being corrected, shorter periods, all of these things. And we only do four sesshin a year. We're continually going in and out of our outside of the temple lives. And this is indeed stepping off the flagpole. But when we touch this okayness that we connect to in the spaciousness of Zazen, that we have the privilege to be able to practice extensively, we realize it's all fine. It is. But if we use that just to comfort ourselves about why we don't need to turn our attention towards other big messes, towards other people's great suffering, then we actually are practicing quietism. We need to continually challenge ourselves to enlarge the capacity of our hearts, to courageously, fearlessly turn towards suffering. Our suffering, other suffering, and be able to spaciously include that. Zazen richly, richly, powerfully supports our capacity to do that. But we need to do that. We need to look at the ways that we are using our privilege to turn away from suffering. Following the news can be daunting, distressing. And it is not the case that this practice should turn us into compulsive worriers. But we should also remember that our option of controlling how much exposure to the suffering of the world we receive, how much exposure to the reality of racism we attend to, how much exposure to the reality of climate change that we can attend to, that is an enormous privilege. There are people who cannot get a day, an hour of space away from racism. There are people there are people in California, in Bangladesh, whose entire country is already under great turmoil from climate change. Here in New England, it's going okay for us. But we are utterly, utterly falling down on our bodhisattva duties if okay for us is the end of the story. It's unclear to me what we should do. But one thing that is very clear is that there is a lot of heartbreaking stuff going on. And it is clear to me that I actually have been spending a lot of time trying not to feel heartbroken in response to this heartbreaking stuff. But heartbroken in response to heartbreaking stuff is the right, honorable, in a way, accurate response. This isn't despair. This isn't worry. This is really letting in the pain and the grief for the world. When someone close to us dies, we grieve. Grieving is the right thing to do. There's no one right way to grieve. But we wouldn't begin to imagine that somehow our Zen practice should mean we should skip the grieving, because in Zazen we touch an okayness, so I don't need to grieve. That immediately sounds like nothing we would want to practice. And yet how are we not doing that same thing? This is truly an urgent matter. And this is us. It is us who are unwell. Us who have this really terrible diagnosis. And there is one who is not sick. Absolutely, there is one who is not sick. Buddha pointed this out to us. Dogen sings about it continually. We touch it in Zazen. We touch it in the gratitude that arises after each evening's Sangha practice together, or the end of Sesshin. We touch this, we see this one who is not well, who is not sick. We see this one who is not sick. We touch it. And the monk asks, so this one who's not sick, that's the one that takes care of you, right? No. No. Our practice is to care for that one who is not sick. To care for that one who is not sick in our Zazen. To care for that one who is not sick in our Oryoki, in our chanting, in our turning toward the world, in our enlarged capacity to be with pain due to our privilege. It is especially our responsibility because we have the privilege to be able to set down certain kinds of pain sometimes. It is our responsibility to care for this one who is not sick in others. And how about it? How about it when we're caring for that one who is not sick? Dongshan says, then the old monk does not see sickness. This is intimacy. This is non-separation. This is the okayness that does not require we not be turning towards anything. This is grieving when it's time to grieve. This is crying when it's time to cry. It is of utmost importance that we take up this practice. And as we take up this practice of doing absolutely everything in our power to bear witness, to turn towards, to act in a way that brings about less harm, less harm, less harm. As we do all this, the thing that enables us to be able to do that is not our fear of, oh my gosh, all these horrible things are happening. Oh, how horrible. It is our connection to the ineffable okayness of this one bright pearl of the universe that includes grief and our response to grief. That doesn't require we protect ourselves or shield ourselves or hold at bay anything. And then we are able to fully bear witness to the joys and sufferings of the world. We are able to be with the realities of suffering, of terrible diagnoses, of potential death. We're able to be with it with a loving, open heart. This is the essence of our Bodhisattva training in Mahayana Zen Buddhism, which is what we practice. with each breath, with each step, with each bite, with each sound. Let us properly care for that one that is not sick. And for the one that is. So we want to invite you to sit comfortably and come forth in Dharma dialogue. Questions, comments, resonances, heart opening. This practice that we're engaged in is irrespective of outcome. We take action, we respond as best we possibly can, and we do it out of the bodhisattva spirit of care. We do it with this open, broken heart. And we can certainly hope that things go our way. But the thing is things may not go our way. And actually our practice is still the same. Thank you, Mike. Feel free also to bring in other aspects of this call that may be knocking around in your minds differently.
I'm so grateful that I've had a very powerful example of James and Jim. It's helped me to realize I don't have to have it put together to still act.
Wait, we shouldn't speak ill of James.
And perceiving them as having it together and showing me the way, but realizing that I can work on nonviolence or poverty or whatever, just locally in my own community, my own state, and showing up as best I can is enough.
I would say it's really the whole thing. When you said what you said at first, I didn't hear you quite right. You said James and Jan, but I heard jeans and chance, which I think is also what you meant. You know, we're born into these bodies. We have no control over that. We have a particular trajectory of health and illness. We have we have a little bit of impact through what we do about our health, but chance plays a huge, huge part in this. People of color, women, Jews, people all over the world who've been oppressed for centuries. You know, it's genes and chance, right? And the people that I turn to for inspiration have not been stopped by that, just like you're saying. They're not waiting to perfect themselves and be some ideal person. They're taking what they've been given and they're moving forward with it, and in a gesture of healing. You know, I think of Gandhi and Martin Luther King. I don't know how many of you saw the movie Selma. Incredible movie, really recommend it. Very flawed person, Martin Luther King, and so inspirational. Given his genes and chance, he moved forward, right, into something that's still reverberating. And this is a very Zen teaching as well. If he or any of us were looking for outcome, as Josh was just saying, then you know, anybody looking at the civil rights movement now would just say, "Oh well, just forget about it. It didn't work." That's not the attitude. The attitude is keep practicing, keep moving forward, keep going, right? Because we don't know what the outcome is going to be. We don't know what the world of the future is going to be like. We don't know how justice is going to arise. I was looking at, I always used to joke around climate change, forgive me for this joke, that it's a good thing we live in Worcester because someday that will be oceanfront property. And I saw on the Weather Channel app on my phone a map of what could happen in the next 100 years. You know, actually, if you want waterfront property, you should buy in Framingham. There'll be no North Shore. There'll be no South Shore. There'll be no Boston, no Newport, no Cape Cod, no Martha's Vineyard, no Nantucket. This is a future that we can't imagine. And it's all speculation, because we don't really know what's going to happen in the next moment. So we could let ourselves fall into despair. And despair is the great first step. If anybody's feeling despair right now, excellent. But despair by itself, grief by itself, which is different from despair, if we allow it to be present, like we allow everything in our practice to be present, we open to it, it transforms on its own into something else, something useful for the world, a sense of empowerment, a sense of being able to go forward. So don't skip that step. You know, don't say, "Yeah, man, I'm going to do this." But this is the first step, right? Whoa! Which is what we experienced at this meeting over and over and over again.
Yeah. It strikes me that this is so important that we talk about it in the Sangha. Because I was sitting here listening to you talk, Josh, and my mind kept darting away. There was this sort of welling up of, "I can't face this. It's just too enormous." I mean, it racism, climate change, and I just found myself going away. But your voice kept bringing me back. And I think, you know, when we think about what we can't do on our own, this is maybe at the top of the list. And that we may be able to hold each other to keep facing, because all by ourselves, all by myself, I just keep wanting to face away. So I'm really grateful that we're doing this. This is so good.
Yeah. And, you know, and as Cindy was saying, as doing what we can is enough, and you are appreciating this powerful work we are doing here. And in addition to being enough, in addition to being overflowing with enoughness, it is not enough. And we need to honestly acknowledge our complicity in that too.
Thank you for the talk. I've often found myself going down for one or another of two tracks when faced with the world's problems. And the first one is to say, well, you know, I can't do much about it. I'll just focus on my little first world problems closer to home. Enjoy what's here. Ignore the dark. And then the other side is to flip completely into the dark and feel totally responsible and at the same time totally inadequate to do anything. So this koan about the monk who is unwell and the monk who is not unwell going on at the same time. So I mean, I've been doing in my professional work some work on ecological economics. And the phrasing of the koan, I think some of what I've been doing in that is it's clear that the economy is very much an unwell monk. But I think there are some parts of the monk that's not unwell that even a lot of Buddhist writers have sometimes forgotten about in there. So. Trying to not go off on either of those two.
Right. And this is also part of what the practice of the Zen practice of Zazen does. Is it enlarges our capacity to hold these paradoxical, mutually exclusive and mutually inclusive truths without pushing it into it's only this or it's only that. And this then and the extreme of despair. Oh, woe is me, woe is me, woe is me. It is also a place we hide. That's, in a way, that's another way that we can keep together this broken heart.
Thank you so very much, Josh, for covering both of these subjects. And what I just felt coming up listening to you with the climate change is when I was a girl in seventh grade, I remember having the opportunity to go to Europe and seeing Pompeii and looking at all the people in their spots. And a question that just arose in me is, why didn't somebody say anything? Why didn't anybody do anything? And I have such a deeper understanding now. And in the work, the multicultural work that I've done, this feeling of being with my friends, that when a witch hunt comes, there's almost nothing that can happen. And then how strange it is with the dominant dialogue just erasing it in many ways. And so I'm so grateful to be here because I'm putting my faith in being here and being in what Melissa said. I'm just trusting it will be transformed as I see what my contribution is. So thank you.
Yeah, and this important not to make this trusting it will be transformed into everything's really, it's going to be okay. I think it's going to be okay. I think we're going to be okay.
We're not going to be okay. Not in the sense that we wish that we would be. The idea is to not be complacent. And also to not take on, hey, I'm thinking about global warming and racism, so that's cool.
Check.
Right. It goes back to the brokenheartedness and the combination of being brokenhearted and treasuring and holding and nurturing the one who is not brokenhearted. This is the practice.
So, to echo everyone else, thank you very much for the talk and bringing these topics into our practice for discussion. So, I'm sitting here listening to people, and what comes up for me is that I see clearly a pattern that I've had most of my life, which is, I would say all of my life, which is when I don't know what to do, I do nothing. When I don't know what to do, I do nothing. And it's a pattern that I have been seeing arise. And what came up for me was another reading in our sutra book. I think it's Hongzhe, says something like, whatever arises, quickly bring it into your house and establish stable sitting. And the idea of letting it in, as I've been hearing everyone talk about, which is, I don't know what to do, right? And that can be a place to hide, too. But what I'm talking about here is I don't know what to do, and then and not pushing that away, but being able to bring it in a way, to receive it in a way that where I can get to a stable place of the really, like, I don't know what to do. And then, now what do I want to do about not knowing what to do? I can get some information, I can talk to people, I can get online or whatever, and not letting that not knowing what to do be like the end point.
And not missing out on, not knowing what to do and then doing nothing, not even going to think about it, just going to do whatever is over there. So not missing out on the step of grieving. When I don't know what to do with all of this grief that I feel, the thing to do is feel the grief. And that is not nothing. And yet so often we opt for the nothing of turning away, as opposed to the not clear what other action I can take other than grieving action.
Thank you.
Jeannie was good.
Jeannie, you had your hand.
So I have for many years been an activist, quote-unquote, which meant going to demonstrations and writing letters and giving money. And this has shifted for me recently to looking more quietly at the invisible privileges that I have of class and race, which, as Josh said, is incredibly painful. And looking away is a large part of what I'm aware of doing. So my gratitude is, it's been a very personal practice. It has been my practice in some ways, this making myself keep looking. And I do reading and I go to lectures, but a lot of it happens on my cushion. How I don't want to accept the world as it is, and the culture we live in lets me see this through rose-colored glasses. I am not forced to look at what I don't want to look at. So I am very grateful to be in a sangha that that will keep putting my gaze where it needs to be. So this isn't such a lonely practice. It is filled with pain and grief, but it feels a lot more effective in a way than any of those demonstrations or letters. Mm-hmm. To me, it gets to the roots, the greed and anger and ignorance that we suffer from as individuals, as society, and especially this American society of greed and racism. So, thank you.
Beautifully said, Jane.
And I think it goes back to what Mike said, too, about how we can get caught in this place of anger and othering, and that this coming to retreat is an action we can take to bring peace and healing in the world. And we can practice this not turning away moment after moment. All the different parts of ourself, all the different parts of the world that arise, and we keep beginning to see how we pick and choose, how we disempower, how we do violence to parts of ourself. Laura, what you were saying about this finding the stable place, this our vow is to go into what's here in the spirit of love. Josh, I so appreciated you say that this is not... In Dodgeball, the movie, the logo of the evil gym was, "When will you hate yourself enough to join our gym?" When will you hate yourself enough? And I think it's really important here. We're not talking about getting so freaked out that you finally do something. But this whole thing is an activity of love. The love of opening our heart to this world beyond the narrow privilege we're in. And this work, Cindy, you were saying of not waiting. You know, the wonderful saying, you can't steer a parked car. Right? So you don't need to know what to do. You don't need to do the right thing, but you do something of opening your heart to the not knowing, to doing something. And then for me, it's so important that we take each action as the expression of our love. So yes, we hope for change, we hope for this and that, but when we do whatever we do, that in the fullness of that, we are fulfilling, completely fulfilling our bodhisattva vows. And never enough, but in that moment, who can tell who's sick and who's ill? Who can tell where the world is and where we are? And that's the possibility of freedom in all of this, is not a fixed position, but entering into can't tell who's who anymore.
Okay, Wayne, you've had your hand up for a while. Wayne.
Thank you. I'm glad this kind of came up. I've been fighting a running battle for so many years, back to the beginning of learning how to sit, feeling that, and in and out of various communities, and always the feeling that this is a beautiful cultural accomplishment, but right now it's kind of, it can be a kind of entertainment for the middle class.
Right.
And maybe it will contribute something, but you might be wasting your time doing this. So I come up against this, and I keep saying, this is wonderful to do, but you shouldn't be doing it. There's so many other things to do which cut to the chase in terms of politics, you name it, the whole range of things that we're touching on when we say this is now serious. There's so much to be done that can be done. Now, I was sitting here as we were reading the passage in Okamura, and just my mind was going, no, that's not true, that's not true, that's not true, phrase by phrase, which is natural for us in our school, you know, to contradict ourselves all the time. But I was doing that But it sort of dug up this little, it pulled the scab off. And I constantly fight with this. I'll get comfortable in a community and then just start shaking and saying, you can't do this. You shouldn't be doing this. So that's live for me at this point. It has been recently.
Thank you, Wayne.
Thank you. There's some... what you say triggers something in me that goes back to the complacency problem. So there's a way to practice Zen complacently. But our heritage was not complacent. So the Buddha lived a life of privilege and suddenly realized, wait a minute, this isn't cutting it. This isn't enough. And went out into the world and says in all of the Pali Suttas, you see it over and over again, the world's on fire. He engaged deeply with aging, ill health, and death as a reality that everyone was turning away from, except they couldn't, because it was right in front of them. So this practice that the world is on fire and don't turn away is something that we as teachers have to keep fanning, whether it's personally, because sometimes people can't see outside themselves and they just feel their own suffering, or whether it's external, the suffering of the world. But if we practice from that complacent place, like, I'm a Zen practitioner, I'm really cool, I'm pretty calm and even, and I open to everything, isn't that great? Then you can go down that path, right, which is a path to hell. It's almost a direct path to hell. There's another path, which is what Josh was suggesting, and I think what all three of us are talking about, and many of us in the room, which is really engage, because it's not just global warming and racism and all these other things. This body, it's not going to be here in 100 years. You know, for nobody in the room, maybe we'll add on 120 years, nobody's going to be here. Just for some of you who are younger. That's important to face. That's the essence of Buddhism, that nothing lasts and it hurts and it's terrible and it's sad. And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, so this heartbreaking practice, this is really important. Not just to go, oh man, I'm so cool, or this is so cool, but to go, wait a minute, this breaks my heart. I don't want to die. I don't want people I love to die. I don't want the world to die. I don't want people to be oppressed. I don't want to be oppressed. It doesn't matter. It goes in and out of personal and global. And this is our task, to not sit here and do dead sitting. All of our ancestors railed against that. If you ever read Hakuin, Dogen is such a jerk. I mean, he's always criticizing these people. This is our job, not to be complacent. So thank you.
I just want to unburden myself of the feeling that this is overwhelming. And what a shock I received when you began to talk about this woman who was stopped for not making a traffic signal and ended up, whatever happened to her. I began at that moment to recoil. I wanted to hear about the koan and how it pertains to my personal situation. It's like I'm prepared to look at that to some degree, but I'm almost not prepared to look at this right here, right now. And I do some work as a volunteer in the prisons, and this made me realize what a fine line I'm walking. I can only really do it because I feel like I'm offering the Dharma to some extent, or a practice that is of use to people. But in order to deal with the system, I have a variety of different ways. I use humor, I use cynicism, but really at the bottom of it is I just feel in despair. I think this is a manifestation of everything that is worse in people, in me, and it's almost like I don't want to look at it. But I do feel that there's a connection between the Okamura reading and what you're talking about, Josh, which is that you know, to some extent, I want this to be my personal practice, my little project. And I will determine the terms on which I engage with it. And he's saying it isn't like that. It's not about personal enlightenment. But I think what you have done is you have just expanded the playing field. And you're saying, you know, it's not just that you're involved in something that is larger than you in the sphere of practice. You are involved in a lot of this bad stuff that's happening too. And it's that's part of you too. That's your responsibility. So thank you for that. I'm blown away, but I see where you're coming from.
Thank you, Pierce. And just picking up on how you began with the overwhelmed, maybe we should conclude with giving Dogen the last word here. He has something to say about this matter. He said, "He says, overwhelming overwhelms overwhelming."